It's 4:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold. Later in this hour, a new bill is pushing to increase funding for the arts economy in Wisconsin.
First, the Winter Olympics have officially begun. The opening ceremony in Sochi earlier today featured fireworks, Russian pop music, and Olympians from 88 countries. Much of the reporting leading up to the Games has focused on preparedness, security, and human rights. While these are important discussions, we'd like to take a look now at the Games and athletes themselves with a Wisconsin twist.
Yes, Wisconsin has been well represented in the Winter Olympics historically, particularly in hockey and curling, and it's no different here this year. Here with us to share some of the stories of Wisconsinites in Sochi this year is Wisconsin State Journal sports reporter Andy Baggett. Andy, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Now, it appears that this is one of the upsides of our winters here in Wisconsin, don't you think?
Very much so. We get to whether or not athletics comes out of the snow, whether it comes out of the ice. We here in Wisconsin tend to have the pleasure of seeing athletes that are involved in winter sports, in hockey, curling, speed skating, you name it. Wisconsin athletes have come to the forefront here in the last several decades, and it's one of those ways we can get through the Winter Olympics. Even though it's cold outside, there's a reason to watch the Winter Games regardless of where they are.
Now who are the people you're most excited about that are from Wisconsin who are in the Olympics this year?
Well, I'm excited for everybody because it's such an amazing opportunity to go and represent your country in something like this. A lot of my job entails following hockey. Wisconsin has a very deep history Olympic hockey, both on the men's side and the women's side. There are four representatives from the University of Wisconsin on the men's side. There are four on the women's side. There's also Madisonians, Madison products, who are on the men's and women's teams making history. Brother and sister, Phil and Amanda Kessel, both are playing at Minnesota. Phil played at Minnesota. Amanda is playing in Minnesota, will resume her career after the Olympics. But there are so many stories.
That is pretty unusual to have.
It is very unusual. In fact, when this possibility came to light, a lot of the discussion went to Eric and Beth Hayden, again Madisonians, uh-huh, who starred in the 80 Olympics. Eric won 5 gold medals, and Beth, I believe, won a bronze. So there is that sibling storyline that's involved in this game. That, again, will make it very interesting for a lot of people, but especially for me.
Now in the area of hockey, why do you think it is that Wisconsin turns out so many good hockey players?
Really traditionally strong programs. Coincidentally, the coach of the women's team at Wisconsin is Mark Johnson, who was one of the heroes of the Miracle on Ice in 1980. And his legacy lives on with his players. In fact, one of the championships that he led the Badgers to in terms of winning a national championship was in 2007 in Lake Placid, where he had his moment of glory. So there's a lot of really cool storylines, a lot of fun athletes, but I think a lot of it comes from the fact that both programs, the men's and the women's programs here, embrace the Olympic legacy, and they have very good coaches who turn out players that are worthy of playing for their country.
Now, one of the exciting things about hockey in the United States team in general is I guess the competition with Canada. Is that right?
Correct, especially on the women's side. Although there is a rivalry for the men's side, the women's side is especially pronounced because Canada and the United States have been rivals from the start, and they're the only two, for a long time, they've been the only two games in town. They're the two best teams in the country, and there's a real distant third if you want to talk about Finland. But right now, that's where the rivalry has come from. In fact, during the exhibition season, getting ready to go to the Olympics, the women's teams from the United States and Canada brawled, had a couple of fights.
So oh, really?
It's a very intense rivalry, and what's going to be interesting about this tournament is that if all goes according to Hoyle, they'll play twice because they've changed the format to kind of embrace the countries that have struggled a little bit in hockey.
Yeah,
try to make it a little more balanced. So there's a chance the United States and Canada could play. They will play for sure one time, and they could play a second time for a gold medal.
And so women's hockey starts tomorrow, then, right?
Yes, the Americans play Finland, And it will be a very interesting game because the last time they played Finland, lost. Their goaltender, Finland's goaltender, made 58 saves. He is regarded as the best goaltender in the world. He's played at the University of Minnesota, won a national championship with Minnesota. So there's reason to tune in at 2 o'clock in the morning if you live in Madison or the Central Time Zone when the game starts.
So what do you think are the chances of the women getting the gold?
Well, they earned a silver in 2010, played Canada, lost to Canada in the gold medal game. I think this is a little bit better team in terms of offense. To make a short answer to your question, I think they can win the gold medal. Canada is very, very good. Finland is a dark horse. But I think with the Americans have a little bit more speed, a little bit more experience, and I like the leadership core of the team. So I think that could translate into a gold medal for the United States. I don't want to sound like I'm trying to be I'm not a countryman for this, but I really see a team there that certainly offensively could really do some damage.
Now, beyond hockey, also speed skaters are probably something to watch as well. From a number of Wisconsin speed skaters competing this time,
There's always going to be, in my mind, a connection to the speed skating, just given the fact that there is an Olympic oval in West Dallas, and a lot of people follow come to Milwaukee, come to West Dallas, that area to train. And yeah. So there's always going to be that touchstone of sorts with a lot of the athletes, and there are a lot of ties. And one of the more prominent names is Tucker Fredericks, who grew up in Janesville and is going to another Olympics as the American record holder in the 500 meters. He will have a lot of eyes on him because I know he'd like to win. He'd like to go out with a win because I think he's getting close to retirement, and the medal would really augment his career. There are a lot of people in short track and long track speed skating that are have ties to Wisconsin, whether they've come here to train or whether they grew up here idolizing the Haydns and the Immerfalls and all the other people that came before them in terms of speed skating.
Quite a tradition. Now, another thing that I'm sure you'll be keeping an eye on is something that you have a personal connection to in some ways, the curling competition. There is one competitor that you have been watching for many years, right?
Well, I had the great good fortune of being able to go to the Calgary Games in 1988, and that was, I believe, the first year that they had curling as an Olympic-sponsored sport. Erica Brown grew up here in Madison. Her dad owns a curling rink, has a curling business now. She was 15. She was the youngest member of the American contingent to go to Calgary. She competed in that in those Olympics, went on to be a golfer at the University of Wisconsin, is now a 40-something mother and living up in Canada, and she's back for her third Olympics. So it's going to be fun to see if she can replicate the experience that she had and maybe come back to the United States with a medal.
That's great. Now, having gone to an Olympics in Calgary, do you watch it differently now than you did before?
I think I appreciate it. Just from a journalistic standpoint, how difficult it is to go from place to place, to travel around and see a new city, to see the international flavor that they have at venues like this. I think that I've always enjoyed the Olympics, but I think having had the opportunity to go there and witness it and write about it and kind of get immersed in it, it still holds true, because when the Winter Games roll around, I like to watch them.
Well, Andy Baggett, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. You have a good day.
All right, you too. Andy Baggett, sports reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. Thanks for joining us. And the Olympics open tonight. The opening ceremony is going to air tonight on TV at, I think, 6:30 or so, something like that. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Mike Arnold.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll get a rundown of the biggest news stories in Wisconsin this week, including the violin heist in Milwaukee.
That almost doesn't sound real, doesn't it?
A violin. It's not the usual word you hear before heist.
Yeah, we'll hear about that. But before we get to that, there's been a lot of talk in the last few years about growing jobs in the economy in Wisconsin. But many say we've been neglecting one piece of the pie, the creative economy. That includes the obvious, like painters and sculptors, and the not so obvious, like graphic designers, architects, and web designers.
The nonprofit group Arts Wisconsin has released a proposal that would give state funding to further develop the arts economy, which they say would help the state. The initiative is now a bill with bipartisan support in the state legislature.
Joining us now to discuss this is Ann Katz. She's the executive director of Arts Wisconsin. Ann, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Michael.
How you doing? So could you explain exactly what you mean when you say arts economy?
Well, it's a broad subject. That's a very good question. The intersection of creative people, creative businesses, for-profit and non-profit, creative communities, you put all of those different pieces together, and that's the creative economy. So as you said in the beginning, it's for-profit businesses like galleries, it's non-profit arts organizations, it's media, it's architecture, it's design. There are actually studies that take Dun & Bradstreet numbers, which are the way that we measure the business world in this country, and quantify it in terms of how many jobs, how many businesses. That's one of the studies. There are other studies that look at different federal codes as how we identify employment. But basically, we're talking about the different parts, the people, the organizations, the businesses, and communities that are involved in creative endeavors, and so, all of that together is the creative economy.
And so basically what you're doing is making an economic argument for funding arts.
Right. Well, yes. And it's a multi-layered argument. The reason that the arts are important, of course, is because the arts make us human. Humans have been expressing themselves creatively since the beginning of time. But in the world we live in, and with the rapidly changing economic conditions and all of the global forces affecting us on the local level, we know that creativity is something that needs to be quantified and can be a resource and is an asset. And so if we take people and businesses and jobs involved in that sector, it's pretty profound. In Wisconsin, the nonprofit sector has a $504 million economic impact. We know that there are almost 50,000 people employed full-time in the creative industries in this state. So we've got the numbers to start building that foundation, to shore up the foundation that the arts are not only good for our souls, part of our souls, but are also good for the economy.
Now, is this approach to talking about the arts, is this something that's changed in terms of advocating for the arts in recent years, or has it been something that's been going on since, you know, there was a time when a lot of arts funding was cut on the federal level and stuff? When did that happen?
Well, as I say, I say that I've been talking about the creative economy since the last century, and I have. This movement to talk about the arts, and not just talk, but look at the arts in a more comprehensive way that affects all of us and affects.
I think we lost Ann Katz there. And she was talking about the creative economy, of course. She's the executive director of Arts Wisconsin, and she's been talking about that issue. And actually, we do want you to join the conversation. Do you think that the arts are good for the economy in Wisconsin? Why don't you join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. I'm sure we'll be able to get Ann back on the phone in just a minute. But if you have thoughts about funding for the arts, and one thing that I believe that we'll also talk about is how Wisconsin relates to other states in terms of arts funding. Wisconsin is pretty low on the list, and we'll have a conversation with Ann about that once we get her back on the phone to put that in some perspective as well. But do you think that putting more money into the arts is good for the state of Wisconsin? You can join that conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. I'm Mike Arnold. You're listening to Central Time. And Ann Katz from Arts Wisconsin is back on the line, I believe. Ann, are you there?
Sorry about that. Technology thwarts us again.
Oh, that's okay. That's fine. When we lost you, we were talking about, you know, sort of making an economic case for the arts. One of the things I wanted to ask you about is another thing that people talk about when they talk about funding of the arts, particularly in the state of Wisconsin, is how we compare to other states. And, I mean, a lot of people look to Minnesota, which is actually sort of leading the country in the state funding arts. Could you talk more about that?
This is why this legislation that we're talking about, the Creative Economy Development Initiative, is so important, because there is so much going on in terms of what's the arts on the local level. There's quite an explosion of not only arts activity, but sort of looking at the arts, as we've been saying, looking at the arts in a comprehensive way as something that's part of the economy, part of educational system, part of quality of life. So what's happening on the local level is profound, and Wisconsin can and should do much more in terms of making the investment in that economy to gain jobs, businesses, tax revenue, better quality of life, et cetera. So other states are doing a lot more than Wisconsin in terms of a coordinated statewide effort. Minnesota does have the Legacy Amendment, which provides a lot of funding for the arts. Colorado has the Creative Industries Council. Oklahoma calls itself the state of creativity. And now is the moment for Wisconsin to really step up and make that small investment. It's a relatively small investment that will have a great payoff over time. And so,
why do you think some of these other states have been more successful at getting arts funding than?
I think that the right combination of people and ideas and whatever came together in those states, but. Really, I think the right time in Wisconsin is right now. I really do see, in the last 2 years especially, a dawning of realization that our economy has changed. We're not really in a recession anymore. We're in a new economy, and that new economy is based on creativity. It's based on the fact that creativity, as I said, is an asset. It's a resource, and Wisconsin has creativity up and down, back and forth, all over the place. And so I think that that the stars are aligning right now for the state to seize that opportunity, and this legislation is a really good start along that way.
So, how big is the art? How big is the economy around art in Wisconsin right now?
Well, as I said, it's a $504 million economic impact from the nonprofit art sector. We're talking about almost 50,000 full-time jobs, almost 13,000 businesses. There are a lot of, we're working on ways to measure it. Milwaukee has done some really good research in terms of the 7-county region on measuring that impact. That's one of the things that is really part of this legislation, is that the grants that are made are going to be evaluated and quantified in a very systematic, scientific way so that we can see the effect and then show that the impact has been good enough, hopefully, to keep it moving. And so, what's happening, as I said, I have the privilege of traveling around the state on a regular basis, and I see what's going on in the big communities and the small communities and everything in between. We've got world-class institutions in communities of all sizes. We've got incredibly creative people. So this legislation is really seizing that moment. And as you said, there's bipartisan support. We've got over a third of the legislature signed on as co-sponsors. There's going to be a Senate committee hearing already next Wednesday, 10 o'clock. The Senate Ag, Small Business and Tourism Committee is meeting at 10 o'clock to review this legislation. So it's moving.
Now, a part of this, too, is a partnership between both public and private sectors, right?
Oh, absolutely. This is the Arts Board, which is the state agency dedicated to the arts, is administering this program. There are a lot of people from the business and economic development and education worlds that have already been advising and will continue to advise. And the public-private matching component of this, one of the main requirements of this grant program will be to match the public money on at least a 2-to-1 basis. And from the Arts Board's 40-year history, we know that their grants are always matched on much more than just a 1-to-1 basis. So we know that there will be significant private and possibly other public money from the local level coming in to match this state money. So again, this is a relatively small investment. The state is not the main player in this, but it's a significant player, and it shows that it validates and it gives credibility to the idea that the creative economy is a robust economy in the state and one that can grow as it moves forward.
Now, in just a few minutes, we're going to have a chance for our listeners to join the conversation, and you can do that if you are interested in talking by calling at 1-800-642-1234. But before we get to that, I wanted to ask you, I mean, there's some people who, when they hear you talking about the economy and arts and all that stuff, they start worrying that it could have some sort of an impact on the artistic quality of the art that's funded by the state. Have you thought about that, or...?
I think that I don't think that that's something that is of big concern. I think that the artistic quality in Wisconsin is pretty high, and the resources that make that artistic quality happen come from a lot of different sources, whether it's earned income through things like ticket sales or public and private grant money and donations. So I think that. I don't think that's a big concern. I think that there's every reason in the world to think that this investment is a good one for the state.
Well, we're talking to Ann Katch. She's the executive director of Arts Wisconsin about a new initiative that would give state funding to development of Wisconsin's arts economy.
And we want to know what you think about this idea. Do you think we should dedicate state funding to the arts economy? Are you someone who works in the arts in Wisconsin? You can call in and share how you help our state's economy. We're at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org.
You can join the conversation right after the news. I'm Mike Arnold.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. I'm Mike Arnold.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our discussion about a proposal to dedicate state funding to help develop Wisconsin's arts economy with Ann Katch, Executive Director of Arts Wisconsin.
And we're taking your calls now. What do you think about this idea? Do you think we should dedicate more state funding to the arts? Do you work in the arts in Wisconsin? Call in and share how you could help our state's economy. And our number is, I'm sorry, my headphone got unplugged, just in case you wondered. Actually, the number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. And Ann Katch, just to sort of recap people who may be joining us, you know, maybe they just got in the car or whatever. If you were to do a quick elevator speech explaining this creative economy development initiative that you're working on. Could you do that real quickly?
Sure. It's a public-private partnership to leverage and grow assets and resources through Wisconsin that are based in the creative economy. So that means supporting local and regional creative economy development, arts and creativity and education as a strategy for workforce development, and so strengthening capacity and entrepreneurship for the state's arts infrastructure. So it's a $500,000 program over the biennium. It's a new matching grant program that will be administered by the Arts Board.
Great. A lot of people interested in talking about it. If you're listening and you want to talk about this too or have thoughts about it, you can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. Let's go to John from Mount Horeb first. John, welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you. I like the idea of the matching grant, and I like the idea that the state would provide effectively tax credits or whatever to enable and encourage private individuals to contribute to nonprofits and artistic efforts and design and creative efforts in general. And I hope that it's kept at kind of the grassroots level, because so often you have, some sort of bureaucracy in Madison, which tends to have a pretty heavy hand on deciding what is art and what isn't, and winners and losers. And I'd like to see it democratized and put on the income tax system and let people make up their own minds.
John, thanks for that call. Ann, do you want to respond to that?
Well, I appreciate the comments. I couldn't agree more. I would say that that communities will determine, businesses and communities will determine what kinds of projects will be they will apply for. The Arts Board is developing a set of criteria. It will be based on what is appropriate and appropriate for a community of any size. This is very much a program that will serve the entire state. Communities of every size will be eligible, and there will be a peer panel review process as objective as possible that will use the criteria to make the decisions. This is not about deciding what is art and what is not. This is about helping businesses and communities reach their potential, providing jobs, businesses, and all the other good things.
Now, one other thing that is interesting about the whole community thing and the arts, as I was reading some articles about this before the show, is that it's not just sort of the immediate financial impact. There's also a value. Is there also a value in helping attract businesses to communities if there is a vibrant arts community?
Oh, absolutely. Study after study have shown that that the arts are part of the reason why people will settle in a community, why people will visit a community, why businesses will choose to be in a community based on the kinds of people that are there, knowing that they have talented people with skills in a community. So that whole quality of life issue is very much an economic and community development component. And this bill and this legislation, this program, are designed to maximize the benefits of that, to really help the state invest in that kind of 21st century community development.
We're talking about the Creative Economy Development Initiative, which is a bill in Wisconsin. Do you think that more funding should go to the arts in Wisconsin? Do you think this bill is a good idea or have questions about it? You can call in and join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Let's go to Randy. Randy, welcome to the Central Time.
Thank you. I guess I'm glad to hear this, and from my perspective, I look at it at a historical economic viewpoint. I mean, all the great economies or empires, from us to the British to the Romans and all the ones in between, they all flourished because of their ideas and inventions. And, I mean, without imagination, you don't have great ideas and great inventions, and we need to foster and encourage imagination. And I don't see any better venue but the arts to do this. And I just think it's very important that we foster this type of
All right, Randy.
Yeah.
Thanks for that comment. And you know, you talked about imagination and sort of, I mean, there's sort of an entrepreneurial aspect to what Randy was saying as well. And I'm wondering if this bill is very much of this time right now. It seems like a lot of arts organizations and a lot of nonprofits in general are being much more entrepreneurial. Do you think that in some ways this is reflective of the times and the situation in the arts world?
Oh, absolutely. And it's really the case for everyone, not only in the arts. We are in a very interesting historical time where our old economy is obviously not what it was, and our new economy is being formed as we speak. So, you know, as we've said before, Wisconsin has the assets. We have the resources. We've got creativity, imagination, innovation, and entrepreneurship all over the place. This is a way to bring all of those aspects of our state together and move them forward. Wisconsin deserves to be a leader in the global creative economy because we've got what we need to do that. And so this is a step along the way.
Well, I think you mentioned that you have about a third of bipartisan support lined up for this. How are other legislators or lawmakers who haven't completely signed on yet reacting to this?
Well, we've got a lot of people around the state, in every corner of the state, who are being mobilized to tell their stories to their legislators. It's a busy time in the legislature. You know, we're getting people's attention. The good news is that we have a lot of momentum. As I said, there's a committee hearing next week already in the Senate for Senate Bill 568. So we have a lot of people who want to tell the story of how the arts are happening already in their communities and how their communities could really benefit with this kind of investment. So all of the pieces are coming together at this time.
Well, Ann, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Michael.
That was Ann Katz, Executive Director of Arts Wisconsin, with us to explain how putting more money in the arts could help the state's economy. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Mike Arnold.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up next hour, we revisit 50 years of Beatlemania. But first, we're joined by WPR's News Director Michael Leland for our weekly roundup of state news. Michael, welcome back.
Happy to be here.
Well, let's take a look at one of the biggest things on the table this week, the budget surplus. How are we doing with that?
That's right. Wisconsin has an expected budget surplus of about $900 million, and we've already heard that Governor Walker would like to use that money in a variety of ways, about $400 million of it for a property tax cut, an income tax reduction of about $100 million, and he wants to put $117 million or so into the state's rainy day fund. The reaction to that so far from Republicans, some of them, especially in the Senate, are a bit concerned about the plan because it also increases the state's structural deficit by about $100 million. That's the difference between what the state is planning to spend and how it's going to use its money and what it expects to receive in revenue.
And there's been some action on this within the Senate Assembly Committee, right?
Yeah, a little bit of dispute among Republicans this week between the Senate and the Assembly. So yesterday, an Assembly Committee did approve the governor's tax cut plan. This is after a little bit of talk among GOP leaders from both the Assembly and the Senate, and they've pretty much agreed that they could use that money that the governor wants to put into the rainy day fund and use it instead to pay down this projected shortfall to reduce the structural deficit somewhat. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss says he'd rather that the money go to the rainy day fund, but if this is what it takes to pass the governor's proposal, he'll accept it. The governor says he can live with this change as long as it doesn't threaten his proposed tax cut, which it doesn't.
Now, the Senate has been moving at its own pace on this. Where are they?
Right. They've been moving a bit more slowly on this proposal, again, because there was some concern about what this would do to the structural deficit in Wisconsin. Now that that is at least appears to be taken care of, we could probably expect to see some movement in that chamber relatively soon. There will be more action on this next week as the full assembly is scheduled to debate the proposal on Tuesday. Democrats now are saying that they will introduce an alternative to the governor's plan. They say that their plan will put even more money into the rainy day fund than the governor proposed. It'll greatly increase money for job training and offer more property tax relief, specifically for the middle class.
And do you expect Republicans to be supportive of any of their suggestions?
It doesn't look that way. The Democrats obviously don't have the votes in the Assembly or the Senate, frankly, to pass something like this. Republicans have been saying all along this surplus is essentially the result of taxpayers being overcharged, so that taxpayers should get as much of this money back as possible in the form of tax cuts, and that is what is most likely to happen.
And we'll move from that to a lawsuit that's been filed against the state's same-sex marriage ban. Now, this dates back to 2006. What's happened now?
Right. So 2006, just to refresh your memories, Wisconsin voters approved a constitutional amendment that, in effect, banned both same-sex marriage and civil unions in the state. It got about 59% of the vote, if I remember correctly. Well, this week, the American Civil Liberties Union filed a lawsuit against the state on behalf of four same-sex couples in Wisconsin. They say that the law unconstitutionally blocks them from protections that are afforded couples in other states where same-sex marriage is legal. Right now, that's 17 states and the District of Columbia.
Now, what sorts of things are the people who are bringing the suit worried about? What kinds of things do they want to address?
Well, not only having rights that they could have if they lived in other states, but they say they're also concerned about a piece of Wisconsin state law that is actually much older than this 2006 constitutional amendment, and that is a law that basically would not only not recognize their marriage if they were to go to some place like Iowa or one of the other states where same-sex marriage is legal and then come back to Wisconsin, not only would that marriage not be recognized, they say they could face criminal charges because of a much older law that makes it illegal for residents to get married in another state if that marriage would not be recognized when they came back to Wisconsin. Now, people who have looked at this say that the law was designed years ago, likely passed to fight things like underage marriage and incestuous marriages. And again, same-sex couples, though, say they fear they could be prosecuted under the law, although there's no evidence that anyone has been since the marriage amendment was passed back in 2006.
Five other states are being challenged along with Wisconsin. How does Wisconsin look compared to those states?
Hard to say. I mean, there are, as you mentioned, five other states where these same-sex marriage bans are being challenged in court. In a couple of states, Utah and Oklahoma, federal judges have already overturned those bans, although those rulings are under appeal. Many people have just been assuming that this would eventually happen in Wisconsin. Somebody at some point was going to challenge this constitutional amendment. It's happened now, and people on both sides of this issue say one of these challenges, whether it's Wisconsin's or one of the other four, will likely end up before the Supreme Court someday.
Now, the ACLU just filed that case this week. Do we have a sense of where it's headed next or how quickly it will be moving?
Hard to say at this point. Right now, the governor has declined to offer any sort of a comment on that, specifically on the lawsuit. As far as the future of the amendment in this state, he said voters approved it, and if voters wanted to, challenge it, they could go through the process of changing the Constitution again. He says that, doesn't seem to be a lot of buzz around that right now. But as far as where the lawsuit goes, just filed this week, so it would probably be a little while before anything really starts rolling on it.
All right. Well, we go from that to something that's not really news, the cold. Everyone knows about the cold, but it's been particularly troublesome for people dealing with propane shortages. And this was especially in the news last week as it came to a peak. What's happening with the propane shortage in Wisconsin?
Right. Of course, propane is very important for people, especially in rural areas, because for many people, it is your source of heat and cooking. It has been very expensive this winter and in some cases been very difficult to find, with suppliers often taking care of their regular customers before they deliver to new ones. It's just been very difficult to find, and the cost is pretty much getting out of control. Well, last week, the Governor Walker, called on the Obama administration to create a group that he says might help locate and coordinate distribution and delivery of propane. A couple of congressmen, Reed Ribble, a Republican, Ron Kind, a Democrat, have asked for a hearing in Washington on this matter before the House's Energy and Commerce Committee to see what can be done about the supply and current cost of propane. Still waiting on word on that. But, of course, this is a problem that's affecting not just Wisconsin, but a number of other states, especially in the northern half of the country.
And part of it, I gather, was due to a burst pipeline or something a week ago that's been resolved. But I know people in those areas affected were told to turn their thermostats way down during some of the coldest weather. How has that affected the supply and demand?
Yeah, there's really a lot that's sort of playing into this. We had that propane pipeline that was out of commission for much of December. That affected distribution and created spot shortages here and there. Of course, we've, as you said, had a very cold winter. And you need to run your furnace more often and sometimes for longer periods of time to bring the indoor temperature up. So, that has led to a greater use of propane. Others say that exports, the U.S. exports propane. They say that makes the problem worse. Some are saying that farmers use more propane than they usually did this past fall to help dry their corn crops. So really a lot of things playing into what has just been a bad situation for people who really depend on propane this winter. It'll resolve itself eventually, but not probably without some more pain.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know you're not a meteorologist, I don't think. You
but
could have
play
another
one on
degree.
The radio.
Well, you will now. You know anything about when we're going to get out of this cold snap? What are they saying?
Well, not this weekend, sadly. Sadly, for those of you who are desperately waiting for warmer weather. So the cold weather here, at least in Wisconsin, is going to continue at least for another week. And then Mike Simonson, a reporter in Superior, had spoken with several meteorologists this week in the Duluth Superior area. They say there's signs that there could be a break from the extreme cold coming, maybe in about a week or so, when we'll get out of this sort of trough of especially cold temperatures and we'll get back to more moderate temperatures. But remember, it's still winter, so moderate temperatures doesn't mean if we're going to end up in the 60s, probably something closer to the 30s. So it'll still be cold, maybe not just as cold, and that may take some of the pressure off of the propane problem.
All right. It's a little better deal than the groundhog thing.
Right.
Six more weeks of winter.
Right.
It's still winter, but exactly. The relief is coming one day. All right, Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That was WPR's news director, Michael Leland.
We're also tracking another story, the recovery of the Stradivarius violin that was stolen last month in Milwaukee. With us from our Milwaukee studio is WPR reporter Chuck Kornbach. Hi, Chuck. Thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon.
So this is a story that's been making national news. Can you catch us up quickly on how that Stradivarius got stolen?
Sure. It was taken from the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra concertmaster Frank Almond outside of Wisconsin Lutheran College about 10 days ago. Was missing for more than a week. Finally, there were arrests made this past Monday. And eventually, by yesterday, the police were showing off the Stradivarius. And today, the Milwaukee County District Attorney issued criminal charges against two of the three people that were arrested, and at least one of them has completed his initial appearance in court. The other one may be there at this hour.
So how did these violin thieves end up getting caught?
Well, it looks like there were several things. One is that one of the alleged thieves used a stun gun or a taser on Mr. Almond, and there are tiny little bits called taser confetti left on the victim, and apparently those are traceable to a particular model. And contacting the manufacturer, they found out who had made purchases in Milwaukee of this model, and included, according to police, one of those charges, a man by the name of Universal Allah, who apparently had a concealed weapons permit to carry such a taser. He apparently purchased the taser and then police say gave it to the other person charged today, Salahuddin, also known as Salah Jones, who allegedly used the taser on Mr. Almond.
Now, this is a violin that is worth upwards of $5 million. What did they aim to do with it?
Well, again, Chief Flynn, Milwaukee Police Chief Ed Flynn, said yesterday, listen, we don't have to prove motive. We don't know. We're speculating that based on a previous conviction of Mr. Salahuddin about 15 years ago for an art theft, who he stole a piece of artwork, kept it hidden for a few years, and then was caught trying to sell it. Chief Flynn suggested maybe Mr. Salahuddin was going to try the same thing, sort of keep it under wraps, literally in a suitcase for a while, and then bring it back to the market and see it, and try his luck. No evidence yet, the police and FBI say, of any link to any international art theft ring. Still possible, though, I guess.
Now, for people who hear the phrase Stradivarius violin, the millions of dollars that are being thrown around about how much it's worth, can you tell us quickly why Stradivarius violins are worth so much money?
Well, not many were made. Not many are left. The sound, depending on your aesthetic point of view, is quite lovely. I guess there's some debate in the classical music community about that, but it's rare. You know, think about an instrument lasting nearly 300 years and being played. Beautiful music that's being played in a very nice setting, and you start to say, that is big news when something like that disappears. And under the circumstances of a robbery in a quiet area of Milwaukee, that was another element to this case.
Now, has Mr. Almond been reunited with his violin yet?
I don't know if quite yet, but he did announce today that he will be playing it Monday evening at a concert that had been scheduled for some time, concert in Brookfield, a Wisconsin suburb of Milwaukee, and it sounds like it will be a very hot ticket. I think it's probably the concert already sold out, but that's going to be the reappearance of the Stradivarius, apparently, at least in playing terms.
So in our last seconds here, what kind of penalty will these violin thieves face?
Well, if convicted, they could be sent to prison for up to 15 years. And Mr. Allah was also charged today with marijuana possession. That could add a few more years to his sentence. But again, much to happen on that front. Court cases and trials may happen for several months.
All right, Chuck, thank you so much for joining us and filling us in.
Yep.
That was Chuck Kornbach, WPR reporter based in Milwaukee. And let's take a listen now to Frank Almond. This was his stolen violin. And here's a recording of him playing that violin.
Well, coming up after the news, a slightly different music story. We celebrate the 50th anniversary of Beatlemania in the U.S. I'm Mike Arnold.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay with us.